This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Oh, I am going to have such a great day today. I have one guest, a super duper guest here in the studio with me, and she came bearing gifts. I am so happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper, Christie Award winner, Angela Hunt. Hi, Angie.
Hi. Thank you for having me back.
Well, absolutely. And if you come bearing gifts, she has come, may I tell people?
Sure.
With farm fresh eggs from her own chickens right here in North Clearwater somewhere. Wow. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
You know, I spent my childhood feeding chickens on my grandparents' farm. And I loved it. Well, the two things I loved were feeding the chickens and going with my grandfather to bring the cows in. And so this is a wonderful reminder of that.
Oh, thank you. Hope you enjoy them.
Oh, I'm sure I will. Wow. You have another new book. I don't know which number it is. I can't keep count because I think you have like about 200 books.
You know, the other day I forgot I'd been saying like 140, 150, and it was 187.
187 books.
Yeah.
Wow. And, you know, every time you come in, I say, this is great. This is getting better and better. And now we have this one. It's called King's Shadow. And it is from your series called The Silent Years. Mm-hmm. And this is a novel of King Herod's court. It is an amazing book. I was enthralled when I started reading it, and I said, oh, she's getting better and better. That's all I can say. And, of course, you are a New York Times bestselling author, and it is just so wonderful to welcome you here. And I want to say, before we start, you're going to tell us today about, you're going to lay out the story a little, because it is a fascinating story, but I want to say something about the cover. The cover is, as always with your books, fantastic. But this one is particularly beautiful. I don't know where they get these women.
I don't either.
These models, they are amazing. And in this cover, because we're on YouTube, I can hold it up and people might be able to see it. And when they go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or your website, they'll be able to see how beautiful it is. I wonder, you know, do they give you the jewelry that they put on the models?
I wish.
They should be. I mean, you should make that part of your next contract negotiation. If they're going to put gold jewelry on these models, you have to, you know, for publicity purposes.
Oh, absolutely.
I think it would be wonderful.
Tax deductible.
That's tax deductible. And when you go to your book signing events, you will be wearing them.
There you go.
Oh, so I have, now that's something. You talk to your lawyer, because I'm sure you have a good lawyer, because everybody needs a good lawyer. By the way, my intellectual property lawyer is Larson & Larson, and I want to thank them so much for sponsoring this program. But a good lawyer, he'll be able to put this little paragraph in.
There
she gets
go.
The jewelry.
That would be fun.
Wouldn't that be fun? Mm-hmm. Well, where do we begin? The Silent Years is a series of, explain what it is.
Well, it's a series that covers the 400 years between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament of the Bible. So it just occurred to me that there's a gap there, and not many people know much about it, or even the fact that there are 400 years in between. But a lot happened during that time. The Maccabees rose. The Jews started their own, the Maccabean kingdoms, the dynasty there, their first queen that was a good queen. They had a couple in the Old Testament that aren't worth talking about. And it's just, the world was really, really different by the time of Christ came about. And so I kind of just wanted to explain to people about what happened in those years and why things were so different. When we open with the book of Matthew, things have changed greatly in Judea.
Well, as you mentioned, 400-year gap there. And I didn't realize it myself. You know, I had no idea there was this number of years. And so it's fascinating what you have taken and what the stories that you have come out, you know, the ideas that you have come out with. And tell us about this one, about the king's shadow in King Herod's court. Because this is a fascinating, we know so little. I mean, we know a little bit about Herod, but nothing compared to what you have done your research and written about in this book.
Originally, the Silent Year series, I was only going to do three books. I was going to cover the first one, Egypt's Sister, kind of covers the time around Cleopatra, because I knew everybody knew about Cleopatra and Mark Antony. Well, at least anybody who's seen the movie has, with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. So I started with that one, and then I thought, okay, I've got to go back and explain the Maccabees. And so then I did Judah's Wife, which is all about that. And then I was fascinated with Salome Alexandra, who was queen over Jerusalem during the Maccabean dynasty. And so I did book number three. But then when I finished that one, it occurred to me I still had 60, 70 years in there before we reached the time of the birth of Christ. And really big things happened in that 60 or 70 years, because the Maccabean dynasty died off, and that's how Herod and the Romans came to be in Palestine. So I realized I needed one more book to explain how and why the Romans came and the political intrigue and everything that was going on. So that's why it needed one more, and that's why I came up with King's Shadow.
Wow. Now, tell us, the main characters are...
Salome, who is not Salome Alexandra. This one is Herod's sister. She's named Salome. And then her handmaid, Zara, who was just a simple girl. She was taken in very, very young, so Salome could kind of raise her up to be her personal handmaid slash hairdresser slash dresser slash makeup artist. And so, but Zara is devoutly Jewish. There was a huge war when Herod actually took power. He was named king in Rome 30 years before he actually was able to sit on the throne, because there were still descendants of the Maccabees that were encouraging like the civil war in Judea. So he had to literally conquer the people. He put Jerusalem under siege. Thousands of Jews died defending the city, defending the temple. And so he swept in and just struck people down the street, men, women, children, or his soldiers did. The Roman soldiers who were under him did. And so by the time he took power, the Jews were pretty defeated and wrecked. And so Zara, she loses her father in that attack, because he was one of the ones defending the temple. And her mother was wounded in that attack. So she's paralyzed, which in those days you didn't really live a very long time after that. So she is pretty much orphaned by that war, and so that's why it's actually good for her to become Salome's handmaiden in the palace.
Well, let's take a step back. How did Herod get to Rome in the first place? What was his background?
Okay, Herod was, I'm not even sure how to pronounce this, Idumean. It was a group of people living, they were conquered by John Hyrcanus during the Maccabean dynasty. And so they were forcibly converted to Judaism. So I think a lot of them took it on the outside without being sort of inwardly converted, if you know what I mean. And so his father, Herod's father, Antipater, worked for the Hasmonean kings. He actually served under Salome Alexandra's husband. And then when he died, he continued in the employ of Salome Alexandra. And so he was in position, Herod, as Antipater's son, when the Romans came in. Because when Salome Alexandra died, she has two sons who immediately went to war against each other. She had planned that one would be the high priest and the other one would be king. And, of course, they both wanted all. So they went to war against each other, and the strife was so great and the turmoil was so great that one of them summoned the Romans for help, and And here came the Romans. And so when the Romans took over, pretty much both sons were destroyed. And the Romans took over and made Judea a province of the Roman Empire. And so Herod the Great was, he wasn't the great then, he was just Herod, son of Antipater. But he said, okay, you know, I know these people, I can keep peace for you here. So they named him king and pretty much charged him with, all right, govern, don't give us any trouble, make sure those people, because they're always stirring up trouble, make sure they stay calm and make sure things stay peaceful in Judea.
And send us money.
Yes, I
mean,
oh yes.
That was the, I mean, the Romans were known for that. They would keep the native princes or kings or leaders in place with the idea that those people would keep their people calm and not fighting. And meanwhile, the money would be sent to Rome.
That's right. Lots of taxes, lots of greasing the wheel, lots of bribes. And so Herod would just defeat little towns and villages and take all their money and send it off. And lots of gold passing back and forth, and he knew the power of a bribe, and he was not afraid to use it.
And Herod did go into the temple and take the gold that was in the temple.
Yes,
after they, when he conquered it,
yes,
which of course did not sit well with the Jews. And it's funny, Herod, you know, in the book, of course, he calls them my people.
Yes,
that he is Jewish.
Yes.
But, of course, the Jews never accept him because he comes from a different line altogether.
Yes, and he was not from the Hasmonean dynasty, whom by then they had accepted as our royal lineage, so to speak, even though they weren't from the tribe of David. So the Jews believed the Hasmoneans came from the Levites, so they were from the tribe of Levi. And God always said in the Bible that the ones to sit on the throne were supposed to be
the Kohen.
Descendants of David, yes, the Kohens. So, but Herod, he came in, he took over, and he was very much, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. So when he was in Rome, he actually worshipped and gave sacrifices at a pagan temple. But when he was in Jerusalem, he tried to keep the law. But personally, I think he just did whatever was convenient, which would keep the people around him happy.
And although he would use you know, quotes and things from the Torah,
yes,
to justify his actions or to try to get himself accepted, the Jews really weren't having much
they,
of that.
Yeah, they knew better.
They knew better. They knew that he was not just two-faced. He had a lot of faces there.
Yeah.
He would do whatever. Now, when you were, you know, doing the research on this, where did you find information about Herod other than the Bible?
Well, I got several books on Herod and read them all, marked everything. There is actually a lot of information available on him, more than I expected that I would find. Not so much about Salome in particular, but because his family, I think their father, Antipater, had stressed to all of his children that family is everything. Family is everything. You support each other. And so they were very tight-knit. And a couple of them were killed in the early struggles when the Romans and the problems and that sort of thing. One of his brothers was taken hostage and killed. And he sent several of them away for safety. And still, they didn't remain safe. But so really, he sort of became king by default because I think it was two of his elder brothers were killed. And my memory may be a little spotty on this because it's been a while since I actually wrote it, over a year ago. But so I forgot where I was going. What was I talking about?
Well, where you found the information about writing about it?
Yes, lots of different books. And in fact, I have a reference section at the end where I list all the reference material in case somebody wants to go read some more.
And the Romans, of course,
yes,
kept good records, and they wrote,
yes,
about him. He was important to them because that area of the world, just like they were deeply involved in England, they were deeply involved here in the Middle East, and they,
yes,
wanted money. Wherever they could set up take over a country and get people to work for them and essentially pay taxes to them. That was it. But so I think in a lot of literature, Roman mm-hmm. literature, they do mention him.
Yeah. And the Roman Empire brought good to the areas they conquered because they had a system of paved roads throughout the empire, and communication was improved. I mean, they didn't have the internet and Facebook, and so things could happen in Rome, and then the news would slowly leak out. But in the Roman Empire, news could travel actually pretty quickly. They had sort of their own version of the Pony Express. And those politicians loved to gossip, so they would set sail from Rome to Judea, and lots of news came around that way. And, of course, literacy, the Romans were very literate, and so some of the more uncivilized places that they went and conquered, they brought that sort of thing and their culture to the people. So it's an interesting, the Romans were extremely influential in world history. And we still use a lot of their things today. They had a Senate, you know, and we do too.
Yeah, exactly. So their influence was massive, and many people don't know. You mentioned Cleopatra and Mark Antony. Many people don't know that Mark Antony went to Jerusalem.
Oh, yes. And he and Herod were tight. Mark Antony was sort of Herod's mentor, his boss, so to speak. So Herod was constantly walking on eggshells thinking, what's Antony going to hear? What's he going to think about this? And I thought it was fascinating when at one point he decided, I just ought to kill Cleopatra, and Mark Antony's going to be better off for it, and later he'll thank me. The world would be different if he'd done that.
Well, it is fascinating. I mentioned to you that next week I have Margaret George on, and she wrote a book called The Memoir of Cleopatra, which of course covers this period where Cleopatra mm-hmm. actually goes to visit Palestine, Israel at the time, and the relationship with Mark Antony. And another author, it's like, sometimes when it rains, it pours. I'm all filled with Mark Antony this summer because Brooke Allen, and I mentioned to you that she wrote a book called Antonius, Son of Rome. And so also covers this period and mentions, of course, mm-hmm. Herod. What overall do you want to bring away from to people about Herod? What's the overriding theme here that we have?
Well, most Christians who are familiar with the slaughter of the infants in Bethlehem at about, we're not exactly sure when it happened, but in the, probably 6 or 7 B.C. Anyway, but we think of him as a villain. And yes, he was villainous. He did a lot of really, really horrible things. But he also could be really magnanimous. At one point, there was a terrible famine, and he used his own money to buy grain from Rome, but actually it came from Egypt, and give it to his people. And the remodeling, so to speak, of the temple that he created. I mean, Herod's temple was supposed to be one of the most beautiful buildings in the world, and he did that in an effort to win the love of his people, who were never going to love him. I mean, he could have done anything. So really reminds me of a father who tries to spoil his children, and his children are ticked, and they're never going to be happy.
Well, let's talk about the very beginning of the book. It starts with Herod's marriage.
Yes.
A wedding in which his sister has set it all up and uh-huh. has organized everything. So let's start, uh-huh. go back to that first chapter.
Well, Herod married Mariamne. Now, he divorced his first wife to do this, and he had a son by the first wife. So he conveniently set them aside because she was not Jewish, his first wife. So he married Mariamne, who was a descendant of the Hasmoneans.
So she's solid Jewish, and
right.
He hoped that this would sort of consolidate him as as a leader of the Jewish people.
Yes, he thought, okay, they will accept me now because I have married a woman who is one of their royal lineage, or at least that's how they see it. And the people did love her. And when he started having children by her, he thought, okay, this is it, because my children now have the blood of the Maccabees flowing through their veins. And so they're going to be set. And now I will create this dynasty that will rule Judea forever. But his own insecurities got in the way, and so none of his original plans worked out.
No, they definitely did not work out. Wow. You have really laid the groundwork here for such a fascinating story. And I want to tell everyone, really, The King's Shadow, which is one of the books in a series called The Silent Years by Angela Hunt, is so fascinating. Once you start reading it, you won't be able to put it down. And it is, of course, we don't know which number book, but one of her great books, and I'm sure it's going to be another best-selling book. I'm going to take a quick commercial break. Then when I come back, Angela's going to talk about writing, about her online writing course, and about some of her other books, too, while we're at it. Okay? Okay, we'll be back in a minute.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author? An artist? An inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660. Or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
I am back with my guest here in the studio, Angela Hunt, who has come bearing gifts. First, she brings me fresh eggs from her chickens, and she also brought a beautiful book called Dogs Having a Ball. Wow, Angela, this is fascinating. Tell us about this book.
Oh, it was just a labor of love. I also do photography, and I, for a long time, was a volunteer photographer at the SPCA, because dogs with good pictures get adopted more quickly. And so I thought, you know, it would be fun to do a book about dogs playing with balls and promote, probably inadvertently, adoption and rescue. And so I asked all my dog friends, I put a notice on Facebook, and I said, come get a free photo session for your dog, and all they have to do is jump around and play with a ball. So I had more than 100 of my friends bring their dogs by my studio, and we took pictures of them, and they just were so adorable. I had so much fun just playing with the dogs. And then each of them told me just enough about how that dog came to be part of their family that I could write a little story around each one. And they weren't all rescue dogs, but by far the majority are. And the stories are just really moving. There are some amazing dogs in there that were abused, tragically so, some of them, but are now in a loving home and have made a great recovery. So purely a labor of love, but it was a lot of fun. We had a pawtograph party at a local pet store right after it came out. And so the dogs, many of the dogs were there, and they put their paws in an ink pad and then pawtographed their portraits, and it was a lot of fun.
Well, the photographs are absolutely delightful. I was just going through it, and I stopped at this one. I mean, it's not easy to photograph babies, kids, or dogs.
You have to be patient.
Yeah, you have to be patient just to get that right look. And you have done an amazing job. You've captured their personalities. And really, I don't know, I looked at this one called, her name is Bria. And she's an 18-year-old, 25-pound Italian greyhound. What a look on that face. I mean, that is a smile, like, whoo! Amazing. Anybody who likes dogs will really, even if you don't like dogs, if you just like great photography, because you have really captured them. This is, as I said, this is not easy to do this. Right now we have a dog in the studio just walking through here. I must know about this book. It's a beautiful book.
Thank you.
Really, really, really beautiful. And I think you've done a great job. And as I said, it's called Dogs Having a Ball, and it's by Angela Hunt, who is a wonderful, wonderful photographer. Beautiful.
It was a lot of fun. And you know, a couple of those dogs passed away even while we were still gathering photographs. And I was just grateful that we did it, because now their owners have a really neat keepsake.
Yeah, that is wonderful. It is. I think it's delightful. And of course, if it led to adoptions too, mm-hmm. that is just something that you really, this Tucker. I don't know. I love this Tucker. It's absolutely adorable. Well, so this is something that you did on your own? And
yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay.
Just for fun.
Well, you've done a beautiful job, and I think people will love it. Whoa. You are, as I said before, you are such a great author. And I know I wanted to talk to you about several things. I get a lot of questions, I mentioned, from people who are writing books, some who are just starting off, some who have actually written their books, and now they're saying, why I need help? So it's a variation of things. And I mentioned that one author contacted me, and she's written a book. It's like around 432 pages, actually. Somehow that number just came to me. She says, 432 pages. And she sent it, as you know, everyone knows who has written a book, and you send out query letters, and you send out many, many query letters. And sometimes, quite often, nobody ever comes back to you. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they do. And in this case, an agent came back to her and said, I love the story. I think it's interesting. I like the time period. I like the setting. I like everything. But I'm really only interested in first-person point of view.
Uh-huh.
And so this author now is in a sort of difficult position. She said, like, this is the only agent out of, she sent like 30, 40. I said, that's not enough. You still have to send more. But this is the only one who came back and really liked, and obviously the agent related to this time period and this particular character, and it's whatever, the storyline. But she said she's only interested in first person. So now this author is saying, should I take the time to rewrite it?
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of rewriting.
Yes, it is, because it changes a lot.
It's not easy to do that, and it's not guaranteed. I mean, she doesn't have a contract to do it. If you have gives you a contract, I'll rewrite it. I'll do it third person, fourth person. I'll do it in French, for goodness sake, if you give me a big enough contract, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, actually, if somebody gave you an author a big contract and said, okay, I think I could take this in Chinese, you'd probably go out and start a Chinese course.
I would get Google Translate.
That's right. So, but this is a difficult thing sometimes for an author.
Well, first of all, I would be suspicious of an agent who said she was only interested in one point of view. That's like saying I'm only interested in books about dogs, because A good agent should represent all kinds of genres. But the point of view choice, all right, let me do a quick little refresher. Point of view is when it's I went into the house, I looked at the mess on the floor. Third person point of view is he or she. She went into the house, she looked at the mess on the floor. Second person point of view is you. You went in the house, you looked at the mess on the floor. That was a weird one. Hardly anybody ever writes in second person. And then omniscient point of view, which used to be used 100 years ago all the time, is not used so much anymore except in certain genres, is Sally Smith walked into the room and looked at the mess on the floor. It's like a detached camera narrating everything. So how do you decide which point of view to use? Well, for certain genres, almost always, they sort of lean toward a choice. Women's fiction, young adult books written for girls, almost always use first person because it is the most intimate. It really places the reader right inside that character's head. And so I would choose first person, as I did in King's Shadow, by the way, when it's a female character and I'm really aiming for a female reader and I want an intense emotional bond between reader and character. Third person, he or she, is more detached and is usually used in mysteries, thrillers, men's books. So there's a real purpose for it. When you're writing in first person, the reader expects to have access to the protagonist, all of her thoughts, feelings, memories, her head, period. But when you're in third person, you can hide certain things and disguise certain things because the level of detachment is there. So if I was writing a murder mystery, and the detective is musing, gathering clues and trying to figure out who did it, I would never use first person because then the reader would have access to the detective's thoughts, and that would spoil the contest. Because when you read a mystery, the reader's trying to figure out who done it at the same time the detective is. And there's a little contest going on. Am I going to figure it out before Sherlock Holmes does? We never do. But that's why Watson, a third character, narrates the Sherlock Holmes books, because he can tell us what Sherlock is doing, so we're getting the same clues, but we are not privy to Sherlock's thoughts until the end, when he explains everything. So that setup is almost necessary, for instance, for a mystery. So the choice of point of view that you use depends heavily on which genre the book is. So you didn't mention what genre the book is that this lady is writing?
It's historical, it's romance.
Historical romance. Okay, I could see why first person might be a good choice for that, because there would be an emotional connection, and it's also geared for women. So that is probably a good choice for this book. But usually when you use first-person point of view, you often limit yourself to only one point of view character. That means the entire book has to be written through the eyes of that one person. Now, in King's Shadow, I use two point of view characters, the king's sister and then the little servant girl. And that was necessary because the servant girl had to go places and do things and experience things that the king's sister would never do, and vice versa. So two point of view characters is permissible. But the more point of view characters you employ, the less the reader bonds with each one. It's just a fact. So, you know, there's that to consider as well. So choosing a point of view it's a heavy choice, and you've got to make the right one.
It is. Now, it's funny. So this agent, I mean, she might have a point here. And then also, it's so funny, there's a time, somehow there's a timing thing that goes on with agents I've discovered. For example, last summer, I had at least a dozen books came to me, and there must have been many more out there, where they were almost all four women, friends, who were meeting again after many years, and all of them had some, it was either a mystery or a problem that stemmed from when they were teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, not just why. And it's, you know, how long it takes for a book to come out. So
yes.
There must have been a period where all the agents were like gripped with four people, occasionally a fifth person. Usually that person was the one that was killed off or dumped into a river or something. So it didn't last long, you know? But then I had so many all at one time. And this summer, all I'm getting are neighbor books. I mean, I'm getting neighbor, they're all neighbors. You know, neighbors with problems, neighbors with mysteries, neighbors with murder, but neighbors.
Uh-huh.
All related to, and mostly set like in one little neighborhood. One street, and everybody in. So it's funny how it goes through a period where agents must like, you know, maybe they're all having coffee at Starbucks together or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all like, oh, she's getting a book about four girls, so maybe I need to get a book for, you know, isn't
uh-huh.
it funny?
Uh-huh. It is. Ideas are in the ether.
Yeah.
And so we see it in movies, too. All of a sudden, there's two movies about Helen of Troy or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I find it so amusing. I'm watching more. I had not noticed that until last summer when I, one after another, every time I'd rip open an envelope or open a box, there'd be a four girls, you know, I'm noticing these kind of things more.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting observant, but it's funny. So I don't know. I know you're listening. I think about it. I don't know if I'd want to rewrite 430 pages. But
I think I would wait till I get a contract before I would start rewriting.
Yeah, I would suggest you just send out more query letters because it's not. I mean, I was talking. I don't know. For example, Robert Grace, he sent out for his first book, I think 87, he had 87 rejections. From,
mm-hmm.
This isn't unknown to have lots of rejections for your books, right?
Oh, absolutely.
I don't know, when you started, if you had rejections, if you went through the query letter phase or you just lucked out and got published right away.
Well, I started in magazine articles. So I had lots of rejections back in the early days, because nobody had ever heard of me. I went to a meeting and the man said, bring your portfolio. So I went and bought a notebook and put some plastic page protectors in it and my resume, and I slid it across the desk and said, here's my portfolio. And he opened it and said, it's empty. And I said, I know it's new. I was blonde back then.
Oh, you could get away with it. Okay, we have some blonde jokes here.
But you know what this lady might do is rewrite like the first two or three chapters in first person and see how she likes it. Is it working for her? And if it's not, then stop there and keep it as it is. But if it is, then send out those first two or three chapters along with her synopsis. That's what makes up a proposal and a query letter, and then let it go like that and see if it's better received.
Yeah, that's an idea.
It's a lot better than 432 pages.
That's right, without a contract. Well, which is why I think that your online writing course is very useful for authors who want to learn both to write and something about the business. So tell us about mm-hmm. this online course. I know you taught a seminar here in Indian Rocks Beach. That's 2 summers ago now, right?
2 summers ago, and we recorded it. And so it's available if you go to my website, which is angelahuntbooks.com. It's kind of at the bottom. There's a link where you can download a free sample. And then if you like it, you can purchase the whole course. And it's not unreasonable. It's like $149, so it's not bad. But you get lots of printed material you can download because it's all in PDF form. And then you have, it's broken down into lessons. And yes, we have a big lesson on point of view and how to choose the right one and how to use it. And I talk about everything from the business to how to get started to how to self-edit really well, and how to plot. You know, a lot of people, they'll teach you how to write a 5-paragraph theme with the big, you know, the introduction, your 3 main points, and your conclusion. But then when it comes to creative writing or fiction, they just say, just write. Well, fiction has a structure, too. And so I lay all that out, and this is what it needs to have. The bones have to be in the proper place. I call it the plot skeleton. But anyway, and then I took questions from the audience. So there are lots of just questions from people about agents and the marketing and all that sort of thing. And so, yeah, it's all available, and you can watch the videos whenever you want, as many times as you want. I think it's a great way to learn.
Well, I know I've heard from a number of my listeners and friends, particularly Jim Lamb, who is a poet and an author. They were all thrilled to take your seminar. They learned so much, and
oh,
they
good.
Were so grateful. And they said, you know, some of them had taken a number of seminars over the years, but they said they never took a seminar where the presenter was so gracious and so knowledgeable and just so enthusiastic that it just spilled over into their own work.
Oh, good, good.
Yeah, so I highly recommend it, because you need to have this background. You need to learn the structure and to learn about all of this. And I think, as you said, it's very reasonable, absolutely great course. And I hope that people will go. And again, because whenever you have not registered your name early enough, you land up having to put books on it. You know, sometimes when the internet started, people didn't realize, oh, my name is, you know, I've got to do it. So, but it is Angela Hunt Books, and it's a great website. All of your books are there too, and people mm-hmm. can look at it. And, you know, we were talking also, because one of the things you do mention in there about publicity, about marketing, which is so important for authors today. It is not like, you know, people imagine it. So many people think that, you know, your agent is going to do everything. Agents don't do everything. They collect the money, but they do get you a deal, which mm-hmm. is why you want to try to get an agent. And if you get published by a traditional publishing house, it depends, right? Some are better, some are worse. In your case, you are with Bethany.
Yes.
Which is really a terrific, terrific company.
They have done amazing things for me publicity-wise. And, they're very, very good.
Now, do you do tours? Do you do events? Are you...
No, we've really found that book tours don't really work these days. I mean, I have some friends who've sold millions of books. They're really like A-lister bestsellers, and they'll have a book event and say that nobody showed up. They'll just sit at a book table and give directions to the restroom. So those things aren't done as much today as in the past, because they're just not cost effective.
Now, you, speaking of millions of books, how many millions of books have you sold? You've sold lots of millions of books. This is exciting.
I think it's about 5 or something now, 5 million books sold, but...
Who's counting?
Yeah, you know, who counts?
Well, after 5 million, yeah. Isn't it fantastic? I mean, is it writing just such a wonderful career when you really are in the flow and you're going, not just, you know, having this sales and having these fans, but when you get into a character
mm-hmm.
that, do you find when you're writing that these characters take over? Because so much of it, you make the characters come alive. And it so much of it has to be just an internal thing, that they come into you almost. Do you ever feel like they're almost possessing you?
I hate to use the word channel because it sounds new agey, but you kind of do get this intuitive feel for who they are, what they're about, what they want. And it just sort of flows out of you. So, yeah.
It is a magical feeling, isn't it?
It is.
It is.
But it's also hard work. I mean, I'd hate for anybody to think that, being a writer is just a dream job. You just sit in your room all day and stuff flows out of you. Yes, that happens. But there's an awful lot of, you know, figuring out where a semicolon goes and sitting there beating your head against the desk because you've hit a wall and you've got to figure out what's going on. Yeah. And it's hard work.
Yeah, it is. And because you do have to go back. It's
funny. I remember I was at one of my first book events. I did a speech, and this woman comes up to me. She's so excited. She's so thrilled. I just finished my book this weekend. I said, oh, that's, you know. And I'm sending out query letters. And so I get in a little conversation. And, I mean, she had just finished it the first time. I mean, she had written it and the end. And she's sending out query letters.
Oh,
and
my.
I said, you know, how many times did you, like, edit it?
Uh-huh.
And she had not even printed it out to look at, to read it on paper.
Oh, my.
She had read through it a couple of times, and she did spell check. I said, no. I hated to do it to her. I said, I think you have a little bit more to do. Think about, you know, holding off on the query letters, and you got a lot of work to do.
Yeah,
you know, it's not quite like that, but it is fun when it goes and when that flow happens,
mm-hmm.
and that is absolutely a joy, and that's what I mean, the joy on paper, that you get that joy, that you write these words down and you say, whoa, I wrote them. That's, you know, that's mm-hmm. pretty good, and. When the writer has that joy and gets that joy on paper, that's when the reader gets that joy.
Yes.
And as I said, with this book, King's Shadow, right from the beginning, as we start with there, and I was thinking about how you have to go back and forth into, you know, King Herod's sister's head. And, by the way, I was listening to the beginning of the Audible book.
Uh-huh.
Have you listened to that voice?
I don't think I have.
Oh, nice. Very nice voice. They got it. I'm more and more into what the voice is going to be like for an Audible book.
Uh-huh.
Margaret George wrote a book called Henry the Eighth.
Uh-huh.
The voice for Henry the Eighth is so perfect that you will, for the rest of your life, you will think that Henry VIII narrated that book. She writes, always her characters are, it's their memoirs. So they're, mm-hmm. You know, like they're, the historical character is writing the book themselves. And everybody just has to listen to that. But also with this new book of yours, Angela Hunt, King's Shadow, everybody remember that. It's real easy to remember. The Audible, they got a woman to narrate the book. She gets it. It's really good.
I'll have to go home and listen.
Do you ever listen to your Audible books?
Sometimes. They usually send me copies, but I know I can always get a sneak peek on Amazon.
Yeah.
So
I got the sneak peek. I'm going to get the one, too, because I like it. And I do that now. I find that I like to have the Audible book because it's funny that, you know, of course, I need the book. Mm-hmm. I need the book. I can't, you know, live without the book. But I am finding that so often in Audible books, when you have a good narrator, the narrator herself or himself, when they get to a particularly well-written section,
mm-hmm.
their voice changes.
Mm-hmm.
They, as people, as readers, they realize, I'm reading something special here. And their voice has just this little bit of change. And mm-hmm. so I'm now listening to it, and I say, whoa, that narrator knows when they get to something that is really spectacular. So mm-hmm. you will enjoy it.
Oh, good. Yeah. I can't wait to listen.
It's exciting. Well, of course, we have to ask, what are you working on now? You're working on something. I'm sure she's always working on something.
Yes. Well, I kept going. I started a new series called Jerusalem Road, which picks up pretty much where this one left off, because it begins at the wedding of Cana, which was the beginning of Christ's ministry. So we just keep going. It's just 30 years after the end of, of King's Shadow. And then it's about... It's called Daughter of Cana, and we know that one of the disciples, Thomas, was a twin, because he's called Thomas the Twin, but his brother is not with the disciples, but there are several other disciple-brother pairs in the disciples. So I thought, well, what if his twin was a girl, and what if she did not appreciate him going off with this guy?
Isn't this wonderful? She can make... make a story out of just a simple line in a book. It just sets her mind off. Fantastic. I was going to ask you, how do you keep track of all this historical stuff? Do you just do it in Word, or do you have a special program?
Oh, I tell everybody who's a writer now to investigate Scrivener.
Oh, that's what I do too. I tell everybody especially when you do this historical research and you have all these characters, Scrivener is a dream.
It keeps track of everything for me.
Isn't it wonderful? I love that program. It's so inexpensive, and it is so wonderful.
It is amazing. I do everything, fiction, nonfiction. I wrote my dissertation in it.
Particularly historical characters where you have a lot. And in sci-fi, when you have a lot of different characters and different names, it's absolutely a wonderful program to get. And I think it's like $30. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely, Scrivener is a fantastic program. And I highly recommend it. And this, it's so versatile. You can print it out. And you can do an EPUB version for yourself, so you have it on your own pad, and
you can do a
read
Kindle
it,
version.
All sorts of, oh, it's wonderful.
It's available for a 30-day free trial at literatureandlatte.com.
That's right. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Okay, they're going to get a plug from Angela Hunt, New York Times best-selling author and the mother of some big dogs and a lot of chickens. How many chickens do you have?
I cannot say.
You cannot say. But I got some fresh eggs from Angela Hunt's chickens. Oh, my goodness. I'm going to have fun making an omelet with these eggs. Oh, this is fantastic. Really, thank you so much for coming in today, Angela.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
It's just a joy to have you here. And, you know, it's so funny. One of, I always end this show saying that one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in audible version, or if you're lucky, to hear those words lights, camera, action, and to have your book turned into a film, a streaming video, or perhaps a series on Hallmark Channel. You never know. And you, of course, have a little bit of experience going the vice versa way. So tell us just a minute. We have a minute. Tell us about what you did. How did you write a book based on a movie?
I was hired. They gave me the screenplay and said, here, turn this into a book quickly, because the movie was coming out rather rapidly. But my book, The Note, was turned into a movie.
Yeah.
And I did nothing. People say, how'd you get your book turned into a movie? And I always say, I didn't do a thing.
They just came. It was great. And they said, we're going to do it. And it's fantastic. Okay. Well, thank you again so much for being here in the studio with me. And always one of the joys of life is just to be here in this studio and to be right here with wonderful authors. And also to just say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. He's saluting me. I'm saluting him. I should have been a general. I would have been a great general. Okay, bye-bye, everybody. Have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. Bye now.